never-ending war, the CIA officers he butted heads with told him. Whose side are you on? When Munter's interventions blocked a particular strike, CIA colleagues would turn the knife. Those 16 Uzbeks you saved yesterday, they're going to try to kill American troops. Yet Munter was also more convinced than ever that he was on the right side. After the mess at Dadakel, Obama ordered a suspension of CIA drone strikes. None took place in Pakistan for a month. Obama did authorize an exception to his freeze if the CIA located a high-value target. When drones struck South Waziristan in mid-April, a debate erupted in the White House about whether the CIA had violated Obama's order. As the agency's operations in Waziristan came to resemble an air war, they changed life on the ground. The strikes spurred militants to try to identify spies who might have betrayed them. Around North Waziristan's main towns, Miranshah and Mir Ali, which took the brunt of the CIA attacks, paranoia spread. The Taliban blamed local Maliks who had long presided over the area's economy, smuggling, arms dealing, mining, and government contracting. Taliban gunmen seeking control of local rackets executed Maliks and their family members in the hundreds. In local bazaars, the Taliban distributed DVDs of their socially superior victims, confessing that they had spied for CIA drone operators. The confessions included elaborate narratives about how the agency supposedly distributed chips or homing beacons to local spies. The spy would toss a chip over a neighbor's wall or into a Taliban jeep to guide drone missiles to it. The men also confessed that the CIA had given out special pens with invisible ink, which were used to mark Taliban vehicles for destruction. The Taliban tortured their prisoners, so the confessions could hardly be taken at face value. The Taliban also had a powerful motive to force the Maliks to admit to spying, because that would complicate the position of the victim's tribe and family as they considered revenge, as spying for the United States was widely regarded as criminal. No chips were ever discovered or photographed by local journalists. Although homing beacons are common in police and espionage, and may well have been used by some paid CIA agents in Waziristan, there was an air of dark hysteria in the torture-induced confessions of the Taliban's victims and the rumors they spawned. Kayani had tolerated the CIA's drone program not only because it eliminated declared enemies of the Pakistani state, but also because Pakistan Army officers deployed to Waziristan informed him that the strikes were, for the most part, popular among Maliks and tribes opposed to the Taliban. The missile strikes encouraged fence-sitters to stay away from the militants, his generals reported, which made it easier for the army to establish some control as it set up permanent bases across the federally administered tribal areas for the first time in Pakistani history. That spring of 2011, a Pakistani brigadier deployed to South Waziristan, where drone strikes were almost a daily routine around the capital of Wana, surveyed locals about the CIA operations. They told him people were fed up of Taliban atrocities and wanted them to be eliminated. One elder said, "Local people wish that drones can carry more missiles." During the brigadier's two-year tour, he investigated four strikes and found only one case of a civilian death involving a man who was guiding the Taliban about the routes that were safe to travel. The CIA reduced the number of mistakes it made gradually after the rough start of its escalation in 2008 and 2009. In the last year of the Bush administration, by one independent count, children died a third of the time in drone attacks. In Obama's first year in office, the figure was 20%. By 2012, it would be 5%. Smaller drone missiles, more precise targeting technology, more experienced operators, and greater emphasis from the Obama White House on preventing innocent deaths caused civilian casualties to drop. Yet all it took was one mass casualty attack like the one at Dadakel to revive the imagery of callous atrocity. The video feeds transmitted from above North Waziristan documented one problem clearly. Pakistani forces still could not or would not stop Haqqani fighters from crossing into Afghanistan. It was not unusual for CIA targeting analysts to watch from above as Taliban commanders loaded vehicles in Miran Shah or its environs with men and weapons, and then drove right through several Pakistani military checkpoints. CIA officers at the embassy in Islamabad would occasionally show these videos to Kayani and Pasha to reinforce the point that the border was open, American troops were being hit as a result, and that something had to change. The Pakistanis typically counterpunched by providing coordinates inside Afghanistan where anti-Pakistani militants operated, challenging the Americans to do something about that problem. The American leadership in Kabul, Chris Wood, the CIA station chief, Ryan Crocker, the ambassador, and Petraeus, at ISAF headquarters, were united in advocating that disrupting the Haqqanis and the Taliban sanctuary in Quetta and Karachi was essential if the troop surge was to be successful. To execute his war of attrition against the Taliban in the short time Obama had provided, Petraeus regarded drones as a tool to decimate the Haqqani network while the 101st's 2nd Combat Brigade hit Taliban infrastructure in the Green Zone and the Marines cleared Helmand. The Haqqanis had about 4,000 fighters, according to American estimates. Drones might be provocative, but they were more effective than Pakistani ground forces and less provocative than a U.S. invasion or conventional air war would be. Hamid Karzai egged them on. "I'm not asking you to go to war in Pakistan, but there's no pressure on them," he pleaded to the Americans he met. "You are getting played on this." Another time, Karzai confided, "Do you know why I'm always blowing up in public about civilian casualties, night raids? I'm trying to push you off your flawed approach. I'm trying to shock you into changing your policy on Pakistan." When congressional delegations visited Kabul, they usually took a briefing from the CIA station chief. Wood delivered what he jokingly called the Chris Wood Power Hour, in which he argued that Pakistani sanctuary was the single most important problem in the war. "We either address the sanctuary and we win the war, or we don't and we lose the war," Wood told visitors repeatedly during his 2011 tour in Kabul. "It's that simple." He had run operations in Islamabad, knew Pakistani officers and the military well. He did not buy the arguments that ISI had rogue officers or retirees operating independently. An ISI colonel was no more likely to go rogue than an American colonel commanding a tank unit. Nor did he believe the army was so weak or domestic politics so fragile that Pakistan could not withstand the backlash if it carried out a decisive crackdown on militants in Waziristan, Quetta, and Karachi. Wood believed that greater pressure on Kayani and Pasha, perhaps private threats of personalized travel sanctions against the generals, or threats to delegitimize the Pakistan Army internationally as a sponsor of terrorism, might succeed. Yet Wood's views never attracted a critical mass of cabinet-level allies. For one thing, Pakistan controlled supply lines to the Afghan war. They could squeeze the Americans if pressed too far. Recognizing this vulnerability, Petraeus ordered planning for air bridges to Bagram and Kandahar from Qatar and Central Asia that could resupply ISAF adequately in case an all-out confrontation with Pakistan closed the routes. The secret planning for a raid on the house in Abbottabad, Pakistan, where Osama bin Laden might be holed up, and the uncertainty of what backlash might result if an attack there went ahead and potentially went wrong, added urgency to the planning for alternative supply routes. But full independence from Pakistani supply lines would take time and involve huge expense, at least until the number of American troops that needed to be fed and watered fell back toward 50,000. This was a legacy of the logistics bargain struck with Musharraf amid the shock of September 2001. After John Podesta declined the position, Hillary Clinton selected Mark Grossman as Richard Holbrooke's successor. Initially, she asked him if he would prefer to be ambassador to Kabul or the special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. Grossman said that was up to her. When Ryan Crocker, formerly ambassador to Iraq and Pakistan, emerged as a candidate for Kabul, Grossman accepted Holbrooke's position. Obama asked Crocker to try to repair the frayed relationship with Karzai and to negotiate a long-term strategic partnership agreement with Afghanistan. Grossman would handle the secret talks with the Taliban. He was a career Foreign Service officer who had risen to become ambassador to Turkey during the 1990s. He also served as Assistant Secretary of State for Europe during the Kosovo crisis, the last war Bill Clinton had to manage. After George W. Bush took office, Grossman worked closely with Colin Powell and his deputy Richard Armitage as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Then he retired and went into business as a Beltway consultant. He was a tall man who wore wire-rimmed glasses and dressed like a civil servant. He had credibility with both Democrats and Republicans. In marked contrast to Holbrooke, he was quiet, methodical, a planner, not a jazz-inspired improviser. "I can't be Dick," he told Clinton. "Dick was Dick. I do things more modestly, systematically." There were those at the White House who wondered if he really wanted the job, or if he had accepted it merely from a sense of duty. Grossman bristled at any such suggestion. He might not be flashy, but he was dedicated, and he had put his own reputation on the line in a project fraught with political risk. At the Obama White House, it was certainly a relief to have someone less freewheeling than Holbrooke in charge of the sensitive matter of probing the Taliban in negotiations. Grossman did understand that his mandate was ambitious, whatever its probability of success. He was to finish what Holbrooke had started. He might help end the war. The time has come to jump over the interagency's hesitation, which will be never-ending, Grossman wrote to Clinton on March 24, 2011, in a memo titled A-Rod on Deck, which adopted Holbrooke's code name for Tayyip Aga. They had come to the point where they had to see what A-Rod can do in a real negotiation, Grossman wrote. Grossman hoped to agree with Tayyip Aga on a series of confidence-building measures that, once finalized, would lead to peace negotiations, including Karzai's government, perhaps in the summer of 2012. Grossman's hope was that the Taliban would initially issue a statement denouncing terrorism, and then they would agree on a political office for the movement, and then the United States and the Taliban would exchange prisoners. In the meantime, Grossman would organize commitments of support to Afghanistan from international allies at a series of conferences. That diplomacy would provide a basis for U.S. support to Kabul if talks with the Taliban failed. If the talks succeeded, countries such as Pakistan, Qatar, and Turkey could provide a circle of support for the peace talks. There was also the possibility that the Taliban would raise the subject of U.S. troop withdrawals from Afghanistan as part of the negotiation. The White House signaled that it would be open to putting that subject on the table in the right circumstances, as part of a larger discussion of post-settlement security arrangements in Afghanistan. Now that the Obama administration had briefed Karzai on the discussions with Tayyip Aga, Karzai shared his own information. His sketch of Tayyip Aga was intriguing. There seemed to be no question that Tayyip Aga was close to Mullah Muhammad Omar's extended family. There was also agreement that Aga had emerged as chief negotiator because of the split within the Taliban's leadership that followed Mullah Baradar's arrest in Pakistan early in 2010. According to one account, Tayyip Aga shared an office in Kyrgyzstan, the Central Asian Republic, with two Taliban colleagues. Also, the Americans reviewed Saudi-sourced claims about Tayyip Aga's relations with Iran. These included an account that the envoy had traveled to Iran, and another that Iran was paying Mullah Mansour, the Taliban number two, as much as $800,000 a month to back the movement's insurgency against NATO. In geopolitical terms, all these unconfirmed reports made sense. Everyone in the region, not just ISI, wanted the United States to fail militarily in Afghanistan, out of fear that if NATO succeeded, America would be able to position forces in the region for decades, on air bases from Bagram to Shindand, near Iran's border. Yet because of Saudi Arabia's endless slander campaign against Iran, it was difficult to evaluate the credibility of the reports tying Mansour and Tayyip Aga to Tehran. He had aligned himself more transparently with the Qataris. On April 1st, Hillary Clinton delivered to the White House the updated plan to advance the Taliban talks, based on Grossman's mid-March memo. Grossman also worked up a 16-page paper, an outline for the next meeting with Tayyip Aga, which Frank Ruggiero would again conduct. On Tom Donilon's advice, the document went straight to Obama, without the burden of another round of interagency argument. Increasingly, the president personally monitored the peace negotiations. The United States had its own extremists. In late March in Gainesville, Florida, the Reverend Terry Jones of the Dove World Outreach Center staged a trial of the Quran, found it guilty, and burned the volume in his sanctuary. The act sparked violent protests in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Early in April, Obama spoke to Karzai again by secure video. His agenda included corruption at Kabul Bank and Tayyip Aga, but he felt compelled to say something about the Florida minister's incitement. "I condemn Pastor Jones," Obama said. "There is no room for bigotry, but no one should direct their anger at innocent people." Karzai reminded him, "8 years ago, we were talking about cooperation among civilizations." That seemed a distant memory. "We're planning a third meeting with Tayyip Aga," Obama informed Karzai. To build confidence, they plan to offer the Taliban representative the possibility of a political office for the movement. The Obama administration would prefer the office to be in Kabul, but if he refused, they would insist that Karzai's representatives join in future talks, wherever they were held. Karzai remained deeply worried that the United States would sell him out by talking separately to the Taliban and Pakistan. He asked about planning underway for a conference on Afghanistan in Bonn, Germany, in December 2011, to mark the 10th anniversary of the agreement that had brought Karzai to power. "Is Bonn a peace conference?" Karzai asked. He meant, would it be the forum where the Americans tried to finalize a deal with the Taliban? Obama answered that they would all try to work together on an agenda for Bonn. He reminded Karzai that the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan would commence soon, in July. This was a time for political creativity. There was some discussion underway about whether the Taliban should be invited to Bonn. Obama acknowledged. Karzai was adamant. Afghanistan should be represented only by the government of the state. It was a warning. The Obama administration was prepared to talk directly to the Taliban, without Karzai, as the Taliban demanded. Yet the Obama administration maintained a pretense that negotiations would be Afghan-led. Karzai had leverage over Washington, and he knew it. Pasha flew into Washington in mid-April. He met with Panetta to deliver a message. The CIA needed to shrink its presence in Pakistan. He and Kayani wanted dozens of case officers in the country to leave. They would not be granting visas for replacements. The relationship between the CIA and ISI should be reset, Pasha said. The same was true for the Pentagon. The Pakistanis would cut the number of U.S. military personnel stationed in Pakistan roughly in half. They would allow contractors who maintain military equipment purchased from the United States, such as F-16 fighter bombers, but they would send the counterinsurgency trainers and special operators home. The CIA should rely on ISI's intelligence and stop collecting intelligence on its own. The timing was awkward, and so was the discussion. Pasha said later that he got into a shouting match with Panetta. In any event, the meeting took place amid high tension. Obama was that week considering two options for striking the house in Abbottabad occupied by the Pacer, the tall, bearded man who walked daily in the courtyard. In one scenario, two stealth B-2 bombers would drop 16 precision-guided 2,000-pound bombs on the site, a massive amount of ordnance that would guarantee everyone inside was killed. In the second plan, SEALs would conduct a helicopter-borne assault. Obama had been leaning toward bombing, but hadn't decided. The president had reached one decision about Pakistan's involvement in any operation, however. There would be none. There was too much danger that ISI would leak the information and allow bin Laden to escape. Also, what if the CIA shared its intelligence but Kayani and Pasha refused to act? As Panetta summarized Obama's position, there was simply too much risk at stake to trust an untrustworthy partner. Pasha and Kayani continued to try to recruit Karzai into a separate bargain. That April, the generals again flew to Kabul. They reemphasized what they had been telling Karzai since the previous year. The Americans are leaving. Don't rely on them. They use us, and then they throw us out. Your future is with Pakistan, China, and Saudi Arabia. If you want peace, if you want the Taliban to make a deal, only we can deliver it. A few weeks later, Mark Grossman flew to Kabul and met Karzai at the Arg Palace. Karzai told him that he might have to choose Pakistan, not the United States. "At least we know now what Pakistan wants," Karzai said. "They told us, like Bush, either you are with us or against us. But if you are against us, the U.S. and Europe will not save you." Karzai went into one of his soliloquies. "I have been the most vicious critic of Pakistan and its policy toward Afghanistan long before 9/11, he said. "Records of your embassies will show it. They killed my father, and I have stood against them for that reason." Yet for 3 years, Karzai continued, he had not spoken a word against Pakistan in public because he had lost hope in America's ability to manage ISI. "Can you find a way to bring stability to Afghanistan without the cooperation of Pakistan?" Karzai demanded. "If you can find that way, I can give you everything else. If you can't, then we have to humbly accept a deal with honor," meaning with Islamabad. "Pakistan has Islam in their hands, madrasas, suicide bombs." To make matters worse, the United States and NATO had attacked Afghan patriotism, humiliating the country. "Even the communists showed more patriotism than us," Karzai continued. "This is a government on contract. It is not a government for a patriot. Either we make a deal with Pakistan, or the U.S. must work for Afghanistan's protection rather than undermine Afghanistan's patriots. You tell me, Mr. Grossman, are you ready?" There is nobody in the U.S. that fears a strong and self-confident Afghanistan, Grossman assured him. He tried to steer the conversation back to the subject of negotiating with the Taliban. He was hoping to win Karzai's support for the next round of talks with Tayyip Aga. But Karzai went on. He would not sign a strategic partnership agreement with the United States if it was to be a partnership in war without a change in Pakistan's conduct, because that means failure. In the end, Karzai said, "It's easier to be friendly with Pakistan. Pasha knows where Mullah Omar is. We know what goes on there in Quetta. Nothing will change unless we make a deal with Pakistan, or stop Pakistan." Grossman returned to the embassy's residential skyscraper to sleep. His job was extremely difficult, but it was his habit of mind after decades in diplomacy to press on, one step at a time. There was no eliding the intractability of the parties he was supposed to corral through negotiation. One was a radical militia movement whose leader hadn't been seen in a decade. Another was an increasingly hostile military and intelligence service that controlled about 100 nuclear weapons. A third was Karzai, who had lost confidence in the United States and who sometimes spoke about the future like an unhinged street preacher. It was Sunday, May 1st, 2011, in Afghanistan, 10 hours ahead of Washington. The next morning, Grossman woke to the news from Abbottabad. Chapter 30. Martyrs' Day. Martyrs' Day was the Pakistani military's annual remembrance of fallen soldiers and officers. 5,000 people crowded into a parade ground at General Headquarters in Rawalpindi on the evening of April 30th. A mournful procession of hundreds of children, widows, and parents shuffled in to inaugurate the formal ceremony. Ashfaq Kayani stood at attention in a dress uniform, the brim of his hat pulled low over his forehead, his chest draped with ribbons and medals. Then he took his seat as two presenters addressed the crowd from podiums on a marble rise. One was an attractive woman whose uncovered hair blew in the hot breeze. A second woman, dressed like a Karachi model, belted out a song of remembrance. Images depicting army heroism flashed by on two large outdoor screens. Officers teaching destitute children, rescuing civilians from floods, delivering aid to earthquake victims. The presenters told stories of the fallen and interviewed a widow on stage. Finally, an honor guard goose-stepped forward. Kayani tucked a swagger stick under his left arm, laid a wreath at a marble memorial, stood to fold his hands in prayer, and then ascended the stage to read out a 10-minute speech. He said that Pakistan is an Islamic and ideological country, the foundations of which are based on the blood of hundreds of thousands of martyrs who had sacrificed their lives to realize the dream of a prosperous and strong nation. The country was passing through a critical juncture of its history, Kayani continued. Its military carried out its responsibilities, whether in the fight against terror, services in flood and earthquake-affected areas, or safeguarding the borders. He quoted Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Pakistan's founder. We have to make future generations secure and not let disappointments dominate us. The following night, at home at Army House, Kayani was still awake, smoking Dunhills, when an orderly interrupted. It was about 1 a.m. Major General Ishfaq Nadim, the Director General of Military Operations, was on the line. A helicopter has crashed at Abbottabad, Nadim reported. Is it one of ours? Kayani asked. It would be highly unusual for a Pakistani helicopter to be flying in that area at night. It was much more likely that Pakistan was under foreign attack. Kayani's first thought was that someone was staging a strike on one of Pakistan's nuclear facilities. There were several in the region. In the flurry of telephone calls that followed, Kayani spoke to Air Chief Marshal Rao Kamar Suleiman. They discussed ordering two F-16 fighter bombers into the air. Exactly what transpired on this call is not clear. The commanders did agree to scramble the jets from a base some 500 miles from Abbottabad. It also seems likely that by the time they made this decision, Kayani knew from ISI and the police in Abbottabad that the helicopter raiders were Americans and that the house they had attacked had been a hiding place for Osama bin Laden. By one account, provided afterward to Pakistani journalists by senior military officers, Air Marshal Suleiman asked Kayani if he should order the F-16s to shoot down the intruding helicopters if they could locate them, an admittedly doubtful proposition. After a long pause, Kayani reportedly said yes. Kayani later gave local reporters a contradictory account, saying that such an order would have been pointless because You can't shoot down an American helicopter with an American plane. He meant that the Pentagon would know how to interfere with the F-16 systems to prevent it from successfully operating air-to-air missiles. In any event, by the time the Pakistani F-16s reached the skies, the Chinooks bearing U.S. Navy SEALs had crossed out of Pakistan and into Afghanistan. There was no opportunity to retaliate. About half an hour after the first call, the American embassy rang. Admiral Mullen wished to speak to Kayani. It took about 90 minutes for embassy technicians to set up a secure telephone at Army House. In the meantime, Kayani learned the full story. Police and ISI officers in Abbottabad had by now found several dead bodies at the site, as well as Osama bin Laden's wailing widows. The widows had described the SEAL raid and explained that the Americans had shot bin Laden dead and then taken his corpse away. "Congratulations," Kayani said when Mullen finally came on the phone. "This is good for you, but there will be issues here." Mullen reminded him that he had told Kayani more than once that if the United States ever located Number 1 or Number 2, meaning bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri, any American president would have to act unilaterally. In seeking justice for the nearly 3,000 people killed on September 11th, the mission was in a category of its own. Kayani had earlier said he understood. The problem was that this raid exposed the myths he so regularly promoted at events like Martyrs' Day. The Army hyped itself as a mighty institution, yet it could not defend the country's borders. This had obvious implications for Indian military planners. "There will be no love lost for Osama," in the Pakistani public's reaction, Kayani predicted. "But the military and his leadership would come under withering fire. It will forever remain a very deep scar in our national memory and our military's memory that we failed to detect the raid," he told Mullen. "By the same token, it will never fade from our national memory that you guys did it." Mullen disclosed that President Obama had not yet decided whether to announce the raid or bin Laden's death. Although it seemed obvious that the SEALs had killed bin Laden, the CIA was still working through a final confirmation of the corpse's identity. Kayani was appalled that Obama might be considering delay. Pakistanis were lighting up Facebook and Twitter with news of the attack, including posts of photos of a damaged American helicopter abandoned by the SEALs. There was no way Kayani would be able to contain media reporting and confused speculation about who the target had been. "Our people need to understand what happened here," he pleaded. "We're not going to be able to manage the Pakistani media without you confirming this. You can explain it to them. They need to understand that this was bin Laden, and not just some ordinary U.S. operation." In fact, as Mullen and Kayani talked, the White House was moving to disclose the news publicly, soon. Kayani returned to the themes of the secret warning letter he had written to Mullen the previous August, when there was loose talk in America of bombing Pakistan. Direct American military action in the country would only turn public opinion against the United States and fortify extremists, Kayani had written. Privately, he was aggravated. He would have been prepared to put a Pakistani face on a raid on the Abbottabad compound. He knew there was mistrust, but ISI and the police had arrested Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of September 11th, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and other high-value al-Qaeda leaders in joint operations where there had been no leaks. The Americans had the drones and satellites necessary to watch overhead at Abbottabad to make sure the Pakistanis did exactly what was required and that bin Laden did not escape. If the Obama administration had wanted to be good partners, they could have worked out a way. Instead, they had humiliated the Pakistani military and him. Kayani and Pasha had already moved to reset the relationship after the Raymond Davis matter to reduce the American presence in their country, but this event would change public opinion and stir emotions in the Army's officer class. It was the end of an era between the United States and Pakistan. The full story of Osama bin Laden's long fugitive exile in Pakistan may never be known. He appears to have lived in about 4 different houses in towns in the northwest of the country before moving to Abbottabad in August 2005, where he remained until his death. Kayani had been ISI director for less than a year when bin Laden set up in Abbottabad. The Al-Qaeda emir and his family enjoyed support from a sizable, complex network inside Pakistan. Document manufacturers, fundraisers, bankers, couriers, and guards. His youngest wife, Amal, gave birth to 4 children in Pakistani hospitals or clinics after 2002. Bin Laden limited his movements, rarely leaving his homes, but he did travel on Pakistani roads numerous times without getting caught, as did his sons and wives. Amal traveled at least once on an internal flight. In one case, a man dressed as a policeman accompanied bin Laden, according to one of the women who traveled with him. It is entirely plausible that ISI ran a highly compartmented, cautious support operation involving a small number of case officers or contractors who could maintain deniability. Yet there remains no authoritative evidence, on-the-record testimony, letters, or documents, of knowing complicity by ISI or the Pakistani state. Indeed, passages from bin Laden's letters suggest that he did not have reliable or regular contact with the Pakistani state. In one 2010 letter, he warned against allowing his sons to pass through the custody of a contact in Baluchistan because people that he knows work for the Pakistani intelligence. In another letter that year, bin Laden asked an Al-Qaeda correspondent to bring a card for his son Khalid, who was living with him, and another for himself. He appears to be referring to a forged Pakistani identity card, suggesting he did not have one already. In other correspondence about smuggling his son Hamza and Hamza's mother to Abbottabad, bin Laden again worries about encounters with Pakistani police and makes clear that he must rely on forged identity cards provided by a contact in Baluchistan. If ISI did run a compartmented support operation, perhaps in the hope that it would encourage Al-Qaeda not to target Pakistan, the service's incentive would have been to work as indirectly as possible and to urge bin Laden to lie low. The Americans had publicized a $25 million reward for bin Laden's capture. There was so much corruption in the Pakistani police forces, and ISI itself, that even if the service had been ordered by Musharraf or Kayani to keep bin Laden safe, there could be no guarantee against some enterprising officer in the know walking into the U.S. Embassy or one of the American consulates and arranging to be resettled in Arizona with reward money and a new identity, as had happened with previous informers aiding American fugitive hunts in Pakistan. CIA and other Obama administration officials have said they possess no evidence, no intercepts, no unreleased documents from Abbottabad, that Kayani or Pasha or any other ISI officer knew where bin Laden was hiding. Given the hostility toward Pakistan prevalent in the American National Security bureaucracy by 2011, if the United States possessed such hard evidence, it almost certainly would have leaked. However, the Abbottabad letters do contain references to negotiations between Al-Qaeda and Pakistan about a kind of mutual non-aggression pact. Bin Laden wrote to Al-Qaeda colleagues about the position they should take in such talks, but the letters provide no proof of who was negotiating on the Pakistani side, if anyone. Our stance was essentially, we are ready to quit the fight with you, as our battle is primarily with the Americans. However, you entered into it with them. Atiyah Abdul Rahman, a Libyan-born al-Qaeda operator who wrote regularly to bin Laden, reported in July 2010, referring to apparent contacts with the Pakistani state. If you leave us alone, then we will leave you alone. This passage and others suggest that al-Qaeda was making an appeal for a truce, not that one had been reached. And there were numerous indications in the letters that bin Laden and his family members had no easy way to travel on Pakistani roads at this time, and that they and other al-Qaeda figures regarded such travel as very risky. The fuzziest period in the available chronology of bin Laden's exile after 2001 involves the first months after he escaped from Tora Bora. There is some detainee testimony that he moved north to Kunar province inside Afghanistan, and other testimony that he hid inside Pakistan. None of this information appears as credible as the testimony of Amal, bin Laden's young Yemeni wife. Her account picks up in mid-2002, when she said she was reunited with bin Laden in Peshawar. By then, Osama had connected with a man known within al-Qaeda as Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, who was in his mid-twenties, and his wife, Mariam, who was then 15 years old. Al-Kuwaiti's real name was Ibrahim Sayyid Ahmed. He was well-suited to take charge of bin Laden's personal security inside Pakistan. He was an ethnic Pashtun whose family came from northwestern Pakistan, yet he had grown up in Kuwait. He could therefore communicate with al-Qaeda operators in fluent Arabic while appearing to locals in western Pakistan to be a native. Late in 2002, bin Laden, his wife Amal, Ibrahim, and his wife Mariam traveled by coach, a bus or a minibus, in the company of a man dressed as a police officer. They rode to the Shagla district of Swat, about 80 miles northwest of Islamabad, a mountain resort long influenced by conservative Islamist preachers. The foursome stayed in the region for 8 or 9 months, in 2 different houses, according to Amal. Mariam remembered a stay in just one home for 6 to 9 months, a house in a beautiful area with a river behind it. A Pakistani investigative commission later reported that the house belonged to Mariam's father. Ibrahim's brother Abrar joined them and got married during this period. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed visited for about 2 weeks. Bin Laden busied himself recording an audio tape in which he praised mass casualty terrorist attacks in Bali, Moscow, and Jordan, and he composed long written statements about the urgency of jihad against Americans and Jews. Early in March 2003, Pakistani police, working with the CIA and the FBI, arrested Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Rawalpindi. Bin Laden and his wife fled Swat 3 days later. The letters and travel documents seized from KSM provided insights into bin Laden's support network in Pakistan, but no target address. The documents showed that bin Laden's children and wives had access to passports, visas, and trusted escorts, allowing these family members to move through Karachi and eventually to seek refuge in Iran. Yet the fact that close family members, such as bin Laden's son Sa'ad, and 2 of Osama's older wives went to Iran in 2002, a Shiite-majority country hostile to al-Qaeda's ideology, suggested that bin Laden did not have cooperation, or at least not extensive cooperation, from the Pakistani state. Otherwise, he would have tried to avoid exposing loved ones to Iran. Later letters make clear that he would have preferred to have all of his family in Pakistan. ISI's role in the arrests of al-Qaeda leaders, such as KSM, and Musharraf's willingness to turn detainees over to the Americans, would have made clear to bin Laden that the Pakistani state could not be trusted fully. The available record contains another gap in bin Laden's movements over the summer of 2003 that comes back into focus in August of that year, when bin Laden and Amal moved into a rented 2-story home in Nasim Town, a suburb of Haripur, Pakistan. The area was in Pakistan's Pashtun-dominated western province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, formerly the northwest frontier province. Ibrahim and Abrar, as well as their wives, moved in with the bin Ladens. Osama, who was now 45 years old, paid each of the Ahmed brothers about 9,000 Pakistani rupees per month, or just over $100, for their services. The house rent was another $150 a month. That year, Amal gave birth to a girl, Aisha, either in a government hospital or in a private clinic. Bin Laden made audio tapes and videotapes throughout this period, including one released on October 29, 2004, on the eve of the American election, in which he took responsibility for September 11th and threatened more violence against the United States. During the Haripur sojourn, Ibrahim and Abrar went to work on more sustainable and secure accommodation in Abbottabad. They acquired land and, no doubt in close consultation with bin Laden, who came from a family that specialized in construction, designed a multi-story compound that could accommodate the emir's growing family with Amal and perhaps other wives and children if they could be brought into Pakistan. The total cost of the project was estimated at several hundred thousand dollars or more. The group moved into the new house in August 2005. 12-foot walls ringed the property. In one place, they rose as high as 18 feet. 7-foot walls protected a balcony on the highest floor. The home had no telephone or internet connections. The occupants burned their own trash. In its design and location, the house stood apart from its neighbors, and its walls were unusually high. Yet in a region of drug traffickers, tribal figures living in fear of revenge attacks by rivals, and conservative Pashtun families that sought to keep their wives and daughters in purdah, many people walled off their homes. This layout was only somewhat on the extreme side of the local spectrum of fortress architecture. The house stood less than a mile from the treed, red-roofed campus of the Pakistan Military Academy, the country's equivalent of West Point, which lay off PMA Road. That proximity presented damning circumstantial evidence of connivance with bin Laden by the Pakistani state, but the evidence was not conclusive. Was it conceivable that bin Laden could live so close to the Army's highest seat of officer education for 6 years without anyone in uniform or in ISI being aware of his presence? Kayani later insisted that it was the case. The compound was not actually visible from the academy. Pakistanis did not routinely get to know their neighbors in the way that many Americans did, he argued to American visitors. The Army rarely conducted perimeter security sweeps of neighborhoods around its bases, except in conflict areas. The Army was not under threat in Abbottabad. In October 2009, 10 militants disguised in Army uniforms penetrated the walls of General Headquarters in Rawalpindi in a raid that killed 15 people, including a brigadier and a colonel. It turned out one of the conspirators had rented a house in Rawalpindi and conducted surveillance undetected for 2 months. In December, another Pakistani Taliban suicide bombing cell struck the Parade Lane Mosque near GHQ, attended almost exclusively by military officers, and killed about 40 people, including a 2-star general. Obviously, if ISI or military intelligence had the wherewithal to detect the cells lurking around Supreme Headquarters in Rawalpindi, it would have done so. Yes, we are that blind, became the thrust of Kayani's argument about the location of bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad. Of course, Kayani and Pasha made the same argument to American visitors about their supposed lack of knowledge of the hideouts of Taliban leaders in Quetta and Karachi, implausibly so. In bin Laden's case, the Pakistani generals advanced by implication a subtle argument, as the Americans heard it. We lied to you about our access to Taliban leaders because our relations with the Taliban are a vital national interest of Pakistan, but we are telling you the truth about our lack of access to bin Laden because Al-Qaeda is our enemy too. Bin Laden's lifestyle in hiding was pinched but warmly familial. He arrived on move-in day at Abbottabad with 9 items of clothing. He watched satellite television on a tiny black-and-white set, Bin Laden had been a TV news junkie since adolescence. In 2006, Amol gave birth to another daughter, Zainab, and Bin Laden released a handful of audio tapes. In 2007, he released his first video in about 3 years, to mark the 6th anniversary of September 11th. Throughout, he wrote many long, discursive letters to al-Qaeda operatives and international affiliates, letters characteristic of a man with a lot of time on his hands. Some of his writing concerned the proper conduct of revolutionary jihad, such as concentrating on attacking America, avoiding Muslim civilian casualties, and cranking up media campaigns. Sometimes he offered specific instructions about operations or hostage exchanges. He issued what he evidently believed to be binding decisions about al-Qaeda alliances with allies in Iraq, North Africa, and Somalia. He wrote frequently about the welfare of those sons and wives from whom he remained separated. As the university-educated scion of a modern Arabian business family, Bin Laden had always considered himself an expert on finance, and he distributed detailed, if quirky, investment advice. In a 2010 letter, he advised that ransom proceeds from a kidnapping of an Afghan should be invested in gold, euros, Kuwaiti dinars, and Chinese renminbi. He was bullish on gold, which usually rose in price whenever the world was engulfed in chaos, which Bin Laden sought to create, and he suggested that his correspondent monitor price fluctuations and buy in at $1,500 an ounce whenever that was possible. He was paranoid about American aerial and electronic surveillance capabilities. He urged al-Qaeda allies in North Africa to grow more trees to hide from predator drones and spy satellites. He asked supporters trying to smuggle his wife and son from Iran to travel only on cloudy days. He repeatedly urged allies to stay out of Waziristan because of the dangers of aerial surveillance and drone strikes. He reminded a colleague considering a media interview that even a trusted journalist may be under surveillance that neither we nor they can perceive, either on the ground or via satellite. Also, a chip could be planted in a piece of their equipment. He wrote to two of his sons that al-Qaeda had decided that Waziristan was well known to the enemy, and that it would be necessary to shift to Peshawar, where CIA drones did not operate. He offered complex instructions about how to slip into Peshawar. He was as paranoid about Iran as he was about the CIA. He worried that Iranian doctors might use medical treatment as a pretense to inject his sons with tracking chips. The syringe size may be normal, but the needle is expected to be larger than normal size, Bin Laden wrote. The chip size may be as long as a seed of grain, but very thin and smooth. In another letter, he noted that the most important security issues in the cities is controlling children by not getting out of the house except for extreme necessity like medical care and teaching them the local language, and that they do not get to the yard of the house without an adult who will control the volume of their voices. He and the Ahmeds rigged a tarp covering the outdoor space in Bin Laden's section of the compound, and he sometimes wore a cowboy hat when he walked in short loops outside. He did have the ability to call on substantial al-Qaeda funds. He once asked for a draw on his personal fund of 30,000 euros, presumably the equivalent of a CEO's allowance managed by al-Qaeda's finance committee. Bin Laden asked at one point for an accounting of incoming funds by country of origin, indicating that several Gulf states were sources, although his request did not indicate whether the donors were official or private. Bin Laden apparently contemplated arranging for his son Hamza to migrate to Qatar, and al-Rahman queried as to whether he should approach the Qatari embassy in Pakistan to determine whether this was possible or if the Americans will definitely take him once he reached the emirate. Al-Rahman thought, on balance, it was better for Hamza to remain in Iran. Perhaps the matter is more difficult than you imagine in terms of the route and searches between us and Peshawar. On April 26, 2011, bin Laden wrote what would be his final letter to Atiyah Abd al-Rahman. He began by reflecting on the consecutive revolutions of the Arab Spring of that year, a great and glorious event that would inevitably change the conditions for al-Qaeda. The Muslim Brotherhood, then ascending to power in Egypt, was a movement of half solutions, so it would be incumbent upon us, the Mujahideen, to plug that gap. On the Afghan War, he expressed satisfaction that the jihad there was bleeding down the head of the international apostasy until it reaches such weakness that the Muslim people have regained some self-confidence and daring. He added some advice about security. It is proved that American technology and modern systems cannot arrest a mujahid if he does not commit a security error that leads them to him. So, adherence to security precautions turns their technological advancement into a loss and a disappointment to them. Bin Laden was about to be discovered, even though he had not made a significant security error. Since 2002, the 24 or so CIA analysts looking for him from the Counterterrorism Center's ground floor suites in new headquarters had been trying to identify couriers who might ferry his messages and supply him with money and other support. Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti's name surfaced during interrogations of several al-Qaeda detainees after 2002, but it was not clear whether he was still active. Exactly how the CIA discovered Ibrahim Ahmed's true name, that he was living in Pakistan, and that he might be working with bin Laden, remains unclear. The agency released a version emphasizing help from other intelligence services, cell phone intercepts, and street work by CIA agents in Pakistan who identified Ibrahim's jeep and followed it to Abbottabad. Operation Neptune Spear, the carefully rehearsed plan to deliver SEALs to Abbottabad by helicopter, launched on May 1st from Jalalabad. The attackers faced a disruption early on when one of the two helicopters carrying the assault team crash-landed at the Abbottabad compound. The pilots of the second helicopter then landed in a different place from where they had intended. This led the SEALs to improvise. One team approached the outer building where Ibrahim and his family lived. They pounded on the door with a sledgehammer. Somebody shot at them from inside. They shot back and killed a man who turned out to be Ibrahim. Inside the main house, they also killed Abrar, his wife, and then, as they climbed higher up the stairs, Osama's son Khalid. On the top floor, they shot bin Laden in the head and several times in the chest as he lay writhing on the floor. The SEALs shot and wounded Amal, but she and Mariam, Ibrahim's widow, survived, and were later taken into custody by Pakistani police. The killing of Osama bin Laden had many reverberations. It delivered justice for the victims of September 11th. It disrupted the founding branch of al-Qaeda and delivered the organization to a turgid successor, Zawahiri. It achieved a significant goal of Barack Obama's surge of troops into Afghanistan, creating political space for Obama to carry out the rapid troop withdrawal from Afghanistan that he increasingly believed was the correct policy. And for anyone who had not yet come to terms with the depths of nuclear-armed Pakistan's disorder or its stew of international terrorists working or at least living side by side with prestigious institutions of the Pakistani state, the raid provided bracing clarity. Among those shocked into recognition were many disgruntled citizens of Pakistan. On Tuesday, May 4th, 2 days after he announced bin Laden's killing on national television, President Obama descended to the Situation Room to preside over a principals committee meeting called to review American strategy toward Pakistan and Afghanistan now that bin Laden was eliminated. From Islamabad, Ambassador Munter reported that the atmosphere in Pakistan was one of cognitive dissonance. He kept taking calls from the Pakistani government, as well as civilian friends and contacts. They all congratulated the United States. But a backlash against the army and ISI was building in the media, egged on by civilian politicians who sensed an opening to recapture authority from Kayani and Pasha. The public discourse in Pakistan during those first days